it's time for another episode of I Am Northwest Arkansas, the podcast covering the intersection of business, culture, entrepreneurship, and life in general here in the Ozarks. Whether you are considering a move to this area or trying to learn more about the place you call home, we've got something special for you. Here's our host, Randy Wilburn.
Hey everyone, welcome back to I Am Northwest Arkansas. I'm your host, Randy Wilburn. Before we jump into today, I want to let you know that this episode is part of our special series with the Walton Family Foundation called The Future is Local. We're exploring community-driven solutions, local leadership, and the ideas shaping Northwest Arkansas. And today's conversation is a perfect example of what happens when someone sees a problem in their own backyard and decides to do something about it. My guest is Coleman Warren, a Farmington native who went from running an ice cream business to becoming a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford and is now back home building Compass Foundation, a mentorship and scholarship program designed to help rural students reach their full potential. What I love about Coleman's story is that it's rooted right here. He's not importing solutions from somewhere else. He's building something from the ground up based on his own lived experience and what he knows his community needs. So let's get into it. Coleman Warman, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Randy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's great. I know we've been talking for the past couple of months. And when I first heard your story, and of course, we have a mutual friend in Tanner Green. Shout out to Tanner. He's been
on
the podcast before.
Yes.
One of the hardest working young men that I've ever met in my life. And he's doing some great things with Ox. He's also doing some great things with some other businesses. And he is the epitome of the rise and grind entrepreneur that you find here in Northwest Arkansas and doesn't let any grass grow under his feet. And he's doing some amazing things. But this is not an episode about Tanner, but he's the one that brought us together.
Absolutely.
And so certainly want to give credit where credit is due.
Oh, Tanner's incredible.
Yeah, he is.
No
he
doubt.
Really is. Listen, I would love for you. We typically start off this podcast by jumping into having you share your superhero origin story. What I'd like for you to do is tell me a little bit about growing up in Farmington and what was that experience like?
Yeah, well, my family wasn't intending to raise a family in Farmington, actually. And they were starting it in South Carolina, but then whenever Dad got a job back home in Arkansas, that's where they decided to settle. So they moved here while my mom's pregnant with me to Farmington. And so I feel like we've sort of emerged as a family, and I've emerged as a person alongside Farmington. Because if you look at Farmington in 2000, and you talk to anyone that's been in Northwest Arkansas for longer than 30 years, it's a completely different place.
Yeah.
I mean, it's called Farmington, and it was a lot of farmland, and now you see a lot of suburban developments. You've got a brand new $40 million high school. I mean, it's become this rural fringe, right? This kind of suburban area of Fayetteville. And so for me, growing up in Farmington was growing up seeing opportunity, seeing potential of a place, seeing potential of a region, feeling special to be from there. I mean, me and Tanner were the first graduating class out of the brand new high school.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
What year was that?
It was in 2017, 2018.
Okay.
That was very cool. Yeah. And so there was something about that, though, that instilled a sense of pride, a sense of opportunity. And so Farmington, but we also still had the small town feel of, anyone from a small town knows, amazing teachers who care so deeply and build such strong relationships with their students that stick with you forever. I mean, the teachers that I had at Farmington are still people I go to for advice and wisdom today, you know? And so anyway, Farmington's just, I don't have enough good things to say about Farmington, and it's why we're trying to build Compass, because it's founded on this belief that community that buys into its future, buys into its youth, can really create something special. So.
Oh man, you got to say that again. Can you repeat that?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I can.
Well, no, it's fine. I'm just messing with you. That sounds really good. I like that. I mean, in terms of a community, you know, I've always said that if you invest in a place, it will return something to you, right?
Yeah.
And in the same way, if you invest in a person, the return can be tremendous.
Absolutely.
You know, it really can be.
And I felt that investment in high school as an individual, and I know that my peers did too. And it's, how can we create that for more people in Farmington, but in other rural districts, right? Throughout the state. And
it's really important. And I'm glad you mentioned the impact that the teachers had on you besides the teachers, was there anything else that shaped your early ambitions? And honestly, I mean, I mentioned at the top of this podcast that you were a Rhodes Scholar. You don't, right. That doesn't happen by accident. And it's not, there are many, many fewer chosen for that. And so I'm curious to know, were you always academically driven?
Yes, I've always been very academically driven. And I remember my father's experience and my mother's experience. My mom's an industrial engineer. So she's very smart, very hardworking, understands the value of schooling. And then my father, who grew up in rural Arkansas in Searcy County, education completely transformed his economic opportunities. And so both of my parents really instilled in me the value of curiosity and of learning, but also of getting good grades, frankly. And I remember being like, and this is part of the Compass model and how it's so shaped by my experience and my team's experience. Whenever I was like 13, my mom was like, if you get a 32 on your ACT, you can go to the University of Arkansas for free. Like, I mean, that's straight
full
up.
Stop.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah.
You know, and it's sort of like, that was like, hey, so do that and you'll get to go to the, you know, you'll get college for free. And like, I'm 13, you know, I'm so impressionable. And so, yeah, academic excellence was always a top priority for my family. And then, but then it morphed, I will say it morphed. And I think that's a part of being the experience of having teachers who broaden your worldview and going to college, of course, where that you start to think differently about what achievement actually means.
Yeah.
It's great to achieve things. Who is it for?
Yeah.
What are you doing? What is the purpose of your life in that? And so for me, it morphed into service. And
yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I think.
Is there one teacher that you can think of? I know it might be hard to just pick one, but was there one teacher that really kind of took an interest in you and really kind of put you under their wing and helped you matriculate through the process?
There are so many that I like don't even want to say.
I know, right?
One,
if you say know? One and they're like, how come you didn't mention me? It's like, yeah, folks will take that personally. So no, I get that.
The beautiful part about the teachers that have impacted my life is they wouldn't take it personally. And I know that because they care most about their students and about our success, not about their achievements in it. But the first person I called about Compass was Belen Rogers.
Okay.
And the reason that she was the person that I called is that she was one of the first people that called me to service. I still remember having a conversation with her. I was a junior in high school. I wanted to be a computer engineer. I really wasn't thinking too much about it.
Yeah.
I was good at math and science. Great. You know what I mean? That's great. And everyone's telling me to be an engineer. You know, Asa Hutchinson is running his coding initiative and like trying to increase people's interest in computer science and data science. And that was great. And it worked. You know, it worked for me and my generation. But I remember telling Ms. Rogers that I wanted to do computer engineering. She was like, Coleman, she could just see that like, that doesn't seem like what you're actually interested in. She was like, we need you coming back home to Arkansas and helping to make this place better.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what she like called that for me. And I went, well, that it just almost felt too good to be true. Like, well, you can't just help people.
Yeah.
And make a living doing that. You know what I mean? Like, what do you mean? And so that was the start of it. And so that's why I want to shout her out.
It made
a huge impact on me.
Yeah, I love that. So Belen Rogers. So,
yeah,
I like that. So obviously, there's a lot to be said for your time in Farmington, growing up there, how you and your family kind of came. Ultimately, you guys came from Southern Arkansas coming up here, right?
More middle of the Ozarks.
Middle of the Ozarks.
Yeah,
okay.
Searcy County, like Buffalo River.
River.
Folks.
Okay, I got you. Yeah.
I say we're hillbillies.
Hillbillies. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, tell me a little bit about how you fell into, or give me maybe the origin story behind Simple and Sweet Ice Cream.
Right.
How did that come about?
Yeah, it was really serendipitous, as most things are. My wife and I, now wife, we were dating at the time. We're looking for a summer activity after our freshman year of college.
Yeah.
And you know how important summer activities are to whatever's coming next. It's how you explore what you want to do. And I was really interested in service, and so was she. And so we did AmeriCorps. So we were summer associates for the Food Bank for the Heartland in Omaha, Nebraska. And our job there was to make the kids that, you know, the kids would come as like Meals on Wheels. So we go to like 16 different neighborhoods. You know, you'd have kids and families come up and they would get their free lunch for the day. And our job was to make them come back for more than just the food.
Yeah.
I played a lot of tag, played a lot of foursquare, you know, frisbee. Bailey did arts and crafts. It was like the best job you could ever imagine, you know. But one thing I saw distinctly and firsthand is, you know, I'd gone through my freshman year of college where I'm identifying like with my fraternity or with student government or with all these things that mattered so much to me in my little bubble.
Yeah.
And I suddenly just, it burst the whole thing. My Farmington upbringing, my University of Arkansas experience. Suddenly I was like, these kids are just like me.
Yeah.
And they don't know where their next meal might come from. They just don't know that. And I'm like, well, that's ridiculous. That makes no sense. I mean, I just was like, and then the other thing I saw was how different each of the neighborhoods were, how segregated they were. And it just really got me thinking about the choices that we make as a public and like how everything, you know, does get political. I know this isn't a political podcast, but those are decisions that people have made. And it sort of got me thinking, well, what can we do about it? Also, while I was in Omaha, I tried the best ice cream of my life. And it's crazy because it was like, it's hard to explain until you've tried really excellent ice cream, but I had never had, I'd had amazing frozen custard from Andy's.
Yeah.
And like no shade to Brahms, right? But this was super premium artisan ice cream that I had. And it totally changed the game for me. And I
blew your mind.
It really did. And I was like, this would do so well in Fayetteville. And so it was like, one day I was sitting in class, you know, after that summer experience, and I was like, I have to do something about child hunger. I'm like, what am I doing if I'm not doing something about that?
Right.
You know, I just really felt like this urgency. And then it hit me that what if we combined those ideas and somehow the ice cream could be a part of raising awareness and combating child hunger in the region. And so that was simple and sweet.
I love that. And it's kind of like there's a lot of kind of like social entrepreneurship ventures where, you know, yeah, they have a business idea, but there is a social component to it, like Bombas.
Yeah. Yes.
Like you buy Bombas socks and every pair of socks that you buy, they donate a pair of socks to people in need. And one of the biggest things that homeless people mention is just having a pair of clean, dry socks to wear. And sometimes we don't think it's the little things matter, but they really do.
They add up.
Yeah. They add up big time. So, but
awesome.
Kudos to you for actually doing that.
I had a lot of help.
Yeah.
It was, crazy.
I mean, so would you say that the AmeriCorps experience is kind of what sowed that seed or idea of building an economic engine for social good?
Yes.
Okay.
For sure. I think for me, it was seeing service firsthand. And like, what is the problem? It's one thing to want to help people. It's like another thing to really do it and start to understand where the barriers are.
Yeah. You know, and as I think about that, I would think that a lot of your peers in college who sometimes are just making ends meet or just trying to get by would not be thinking about social causes as much as they do about just where their next meal is coming from. Do I have enough money for the weekend and things of that nature? But you kind of elevated your thought process and thinking to a higher level of, man, I could help these kids that I got to witness and experience in Nebraska, and I want to be able to do that here in Arkansas.
Absolutely, which I think is a real privilege for me to have that opportunity.
Yeah, of course,
right?
It really was,
you know, not worrying about funding because I was on, you know, a scholarship, but that opportunity and that space to think about, well, what can I do and what is possible and within my means to do something? Because it's,
Had you considered other opportunities or other business tracks before you fell on simple and sweet ice cream? And I'm curious to know.
Yeah, no, that was like the initial draft for me. I had had experience in high school with entrepreneurship. Like we did, we would like create, like we created like business plans.
Sure.
And we were trying to win like the international competition.
Yep.
So I'd thought about entrepreneurship, but I'd never made it real. And simple and sweet, it was an interesting one for me. It was such a, I guess a word could be like synchronicity, if you want to say that. It was such a moment of everyone I talked to loved the idea and was so encouraging. It was like, how can I help?
Sure.
I mean, it just over and over. And I remember one person who I have to say is, give him a shout out, is Neil McWilliams, who's this electrical engineer who had his career, you know, in the Midwest and then decided to, in his retirement, to start an ice cream business in Mammoth Spring, Arkansas. And he made amazing ice cream and we actually used his recipe.
Okay.
And I remember calling him the first time and saying, hey, here's what I'm trying to do. And the first thing he said, of course, because he's a businessman, was just, well, the margins aren't going to work on that.
You
know? I'm like, well, they're going to have to work on this. You know what I mean?
And
so I remember Tanner and I drove out to Mammoth Spring to visit Neil, Tanner, Bailey, and I. And then the second time, just Tanner and I, and he taught us how to make the ice cream. We made like 30 gallons.
Wow.
We drove it back. And that kind of generosity, you know, of time, spirit, and knowledge was, did stuff like that. It just was like, this is meant to be.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, what else would it be?
So, what was it? Was there anything cathartic about the ice cream making process that really gelled for you or really just like that hit home, right?
Yeah, it
I mean, it's not always that you do something that you find where your passion kind of coincides with the actual vocation that you're practicing.
Right.
And I'm curious to know, what was it about ice cream specifically that really kind of drove it home for you?
Sugar.
in its simplest form, right? Yeah.
And I want to give a more profound answer, but I loved it. I had like the best dessert on tap, you know, that I could share with people that I loved. And
it's funny because I've just on the heels of a trip out to the Bay Area. I was out there about a week ago at the time of recording this, and I used to live in the Bay Area, which many people that have followed this podcast for years know that about me. And there are two of my favorite ice cream places in all of the world are in the Bay Area. One is Byright Creamery in the Mission District right near Dolores Park. Shout out to Byright Creamery. Their ice cream is, that's probably my favorite in the world.
Right.
And then Fenton's, which is kind of like a soda fountain ice cream spot in Oakland. And it's old school. It's been around, I think, I want to say Fenton's has been around for like 100 years, maybe not that long,
but
their ice cream is just legit. And I took my whole family there and they were like, why are we going all out of this way? And I was like, trust me. And they got there, they had the ice cream and they were like, oh, this was worth the trip.
Right.
And I mean, we had driven up from San Jose to Berkeley and then into Oakland to go to Fenton's. So shout out to Fenton's and shout out to Byright. But you know, you're absolutely right. Yeah. When you know something that it's really good, it just has a whole different level of appreciation.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And I remember having, when you guys were open, the Simple and Sweet ice cream, and I was like, wow, this is actually really good. And you know, you don't want, I mean, you've mentioned another ice cream company, which I won't mention the name again, but you know, when you've had good ice cream, you know it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just, like, there's no mistaking it.
Yes.
Right. And I know that, and that's one of the things that I've always found, my wife and I are always like, man, we got to find a good ice cream spot here. And there are a few now, shout out to Cream. I mean, they've done a pretty good job.
Yep.
There are a few others up in Bentonville and elsewhere. But yeah, I mean, it's like, I always say that there's room for another really good ice cream shop.
Yeah.
You know, there's always going to be room for that.
We got to bring it back. Is what I was saying.
So in some way, shape or form, you got to think of that. So tell me, one of the things that you did mention, that the business was super successful. Yeah. Right. Because I remember where you guys kind of, it seemed like you guys came out of nowhere.
Right.
And you were able to donate to the food bank, but it also required a fair amount of sacrifice for you.
Yeah.
What were some of those challenges that you had in running Simple and Sweet and then the social component too?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think any, you know, what's the stat? It's like 97% of small businesses, especially restaurants, fail in the first 2 years. Right.
Yeah, sure.
And so there was that mountain to climb of, the brand is based around our social impact, and that's the reason I'm doing it, right? Yep. I'm not in this to make money. And so it's balancing that. So it was a lot of volunteer labor, frankly. You know what I mean? It came down, like for me, it just was like a project of passion. I'd say that was one of the difficulties, is transitioning from something that relies a lot on low labor costs, right? And then transitioning that into something that is sustainable. And we were on our way there. Like, we were there. Like, I had labor. Don't worry. I was paying that payroll and it hurt. But like, the transition of going from, we have been open for a year as an e-commerce business and then a year as our food truck, right?
Right.
And we've got a little bit of debt that we're paying off. And then 6 months between, like, I'm student body president, I'm finishing my master's or my like undergrad thesis, I'm getting married, and then I have like 6 months tops, you know, is more like 4 months to try and like exit this business.
Yeah.
That was a real challenge. I mean, it really was, to find a values aligned person, you know, and group that would be interested in purchasing the business, you know.
And I'm glad you kind of transitioned to that. So you actually had to liquidate when you won the Rhodes Scholarship.
Yes.
Did you think you were going to win the Rhodes Scholarship?
And
what happened? I mean, how did you even decide to go after this?
Yeah, the Rhodes was something that had been on my mind for a while, but the first piece of advice I got that really stuck with me around applying for Rhodes is that you're not going to win. And I think that's why, for me, and recognizing winning that scholarship, it's a game of luck. I mean, it's what, like, obviously I had to work to get to this interview stage, but at that point it's, you know, what are the relevant current events? What did the, you know, panelists eat that day?
Yeah.
You know, so you can't expect to win this thing, right?
Yeah.
You know? And like, I think I'm great, but come on. And so it was like, so I didn't know if that was going to happen. And then I also, I think, was naive about how quickly I could turn around and exit. I think both of those things were true at the same time.
Sure.
And so then it became, well, it's September. We've had a good summer. And I don't think I'm going to be able to run this business like from England. I'm not going to be able to run it well, and it's going to really impede on a once in a lifetime opportunity that I've been afforded. And so it's a tough decision, because with all my decisions, to be honest, I shouldn't do that. I think my wife would be like, you do too much of this, but I take into account everyone that's been involved. Yeah. I mean, me getting to go to Oxford was not just like a me accomplishing something. It was the teachers. It was my parents. It's my, you know, it's my friends. It's the community that's uplifted me. So it's like, I need to be in Oxford. Like, this is an experience that I need to have, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how, that's what I prioritized. But then it became, well, now I have a bit of money. It's like, what do we do with it? Do we start it back up, or do we, you know, use it for something new? Does it repurpose in some way? And that right. repurposing became the Compass Foundation.
Okay. Okay. So just real quickly, because I don't want to gloss over the whole Rhodes Scholarship experience.
Sure.
Just for the edification of our listeners, can you articulate how hard it is to become a Rhodes Scholar?
Sure.
Right? I mean, because I don't think people fully understand it.
Okay. The process is, you have 9 recommendation letters.
Sure.
You have a 2-page resume.
Yep.
And you have an 1,000-word personal statement. And that's all you get to submit. And you're going to compete against, there were like 3,000 applications. But for example, Harvard, or any institution, but Harvard is the, you know, a good example, any institution can only put up 28 applicants.
Okay.
Right. And so that's why that number is only like 3,000, because sure. there's only so many you can actually put forward.
Right.
But you're competing against
the best of the best.
You're competing against the best of the best from every single school. And it was, so that's why it's like a, who knows what's going to happen. I mean, we hadn't had a Rhodes Scholar in 20 years, right?
From,
the last one had been
from
the U of A. It'd been in 97. And she is a neuroscientist, neurosurgeon now.
Wow.
I think neuroscientist.
Okay.
I don't want to, Anna Terry, you can look her up. She's great. But, you know, we hadn't had one in a while. So it just was like anyone's game, you know? I mean, it really was this sort of Hail Mary pass, and what are they looking for? And the way it works is I competed against my like region. So that's Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, Tennessee, and Arkansas.
Okay.
But it could be any school. So you could have anyone from any school going there. Yeah.
And then how many do they choose total?
That's a good point. Yeah, they pick 32 total. They pick 2 from that region.
Okay.
Yeah, so
okay.
I was one of 2 from that region. There's another girl who's actually a Truman Scholar, classmate of mine,
okay.
Clark. And so we were one of the only regions that had other Trumans. And I also, we were some of the few like actual Southerners that were there.
Wow.
In Oxford, period, which was also a part of what inspired Compass.
What was it like to be at Oxford?
It's a fairy tale. I mean, it's ridiculous. You're like walking around, and it's like, I think for me, it gave a totally different sense of perspective, like time scale
mm-hmm.
perspective, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Arkansas became a state in 1836. The University of Arkansas, 1871. That's all really, really recent. I remember like, if you had a college, the Oxford is broken down to like 30-something or like 39 colleges. If a college was created after 1850, it was like boring. It was like considered like, oh, that's like
right.
brand new. You
yeah,
know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you
yeah.
know, most of these places are 1200, you know, 1300, some of them date back to 800. And so I think being at Oxford, you can't help but be really grounded in the history of, I mean, I don't want to overstate, but like of humanity, because England has had all, and the British Empire, for better or for worse, has had such a massive influence on our world.
Yeah.
And you're sort of at the intellectual hub of it. And so that was, it was a fairy tale in a lot of ways, but it was also really enlightening, because I also found that a lot of the thinking that shaped my home was rooted in how people thought at Oxford and people like Cecil Rhodes. So.
Okay. Yeah. And you know, I would say that when I think of Oxford, I think of something being a place being steeped in tradition and history.
Yeah, I should talk about that. The fun
yeah,
part too.
Yeah,
yeah, I'm wearing a tux like at least a couple times a week. I've got on
that's just normal wear. So.
Totally.
Yeah.
No, and it was like perfectly normal. Like twice a week at my college alone, they would have, I'm talking like 5-course meal. And you're all wearing your robes, right? Like Harry Potter.
Sure.
And you're looking at the painting of Queen Elizabeth the
First. Yeah, yeah.
The original one that you look up on like Google. It's
right.
Like right there on the wall. And, you know, they give toasts, and it's just, I mean, it's, you're living in a different reality
sure.
entirely. Yeah.
Sure.
And it was so, it's so special. And like, yeah, it's an amazing experience, but it's also like, yeah, yeah. It's also not real.
You mentioned somebody named Nicholas from Nebraska. You guys are one of the only people from small town America there.
Yeah.
What did that feel like being there at Oxford?
Yeah.
Representing small town America.
Yeah.
Right.
No, it was really interesting because Oxford's one of the most diverse places in the world. You have people from all over. And I mean, like, truly, the world just became so much smaller. But suddenly I realized I was like a unique piece of that world in a way that I hadn't felt being from Farmington and being, you know, here I am, straight white guy from Farmington. Like, you know, it's like I'm a pretty, there's a lot like me, you know?
Yeah.
And suddenly in my classes, I studied comparative social policy, which is essentially like welfare state economics.
Sure.
How do governments invest in people, education, healthcare, pensions, whatever that might look like. And I realized like my Arkansas perspective, no one had it.
Yeah.
No one understood the unique history of the South and how that shaped how we, you know, function. No one, you know, I realized like I'm one of the only people here that also understands like rural America and like how globalization, even in like one of the wealthiest countries in the world, how globalization has really hurt my state and what that looks like.
Oh yeah.
You know, and it was an interesting, I found it to be wonderful though, to be able to bring that perspective and for people really cared and they were interested and curious to learn more. But the people at Oxford, I mean, you look and at any Ivy League institution, you know, they shape the world. You know, they just have, like, not all of us, right?
Yeah.
Not all of them, but they do. And so to have the South or to have small town America feel so underrepresented in that place also felt like a problem that Nicholas and I really identified with together. And we thought, well, how do you change that? How do you sort of start to shape that to be moving in a different direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of talked about the absence of rural voices in elite spaces.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and just like, and it's like, I mean, it almost gives you a glimpse into what it feels like to be underrepresented.
Yeah. There are just over 30 members of Congress that are farmers and like from a truly rural place.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
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 I mean, you know, it's, and it makes sense. Like it makes sense because you have lower education attainment. You have economic opportunities are starting to decline. Like we're really reimagining what rural looks like.
Yeah.
And so you sort of see, I think it's a combination of, you know, there's a chicken and the egg happening there, but it's a combination of the fact that we don't have a representation advocating for rural. And then you also, then it just like gets worse almost. That situation gets worse.
Yeah. Sure. Sure. All right. So now we're up to in your early life, all the way up to being a Rhodes Scholar. Let's kind of talk and come back to the vision for Compass Scholars. So you had money left over from Simple and Sweet, and you wanted to give back specifically to Farmington and maybe some other places. Why focus on education specifically?
Yeah. So by the time that it had all, we'd all like wrapped up and we'd like donated some money. We had like $12,000.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't just like an insane amount of money,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But it's enough money to do something with. And so the reason I was trying to think, well, I wanted to get back to Farmington. So one thing about Simple and Sweet is that we had our kitchen in like my elementary school's cafeteria, right? Like, and it was things like that that made Simple and Sweet possible. And so I wanted to give back to the district in some way and the sort of love that I had felt from the district. So I thought, well, maybe a scholarship could make sense. But a $10,000 endowed scholarship comes out to like $400 a year. So we'd give one student $400. And I thought, there's so much more to investing in someone than just financial support.
Yeah.
Right. And I'd recognize that in my own life. There's direct like knowledge and skills, how to write a personal narrative, how to build your resume, how to think about building a resume that makes sense to an application reviewing committee.
Yeah.
Right. Like there's mentors that can help tell you things that you didn't know about a certain sector that sets you apart and make sure that you don't waste a year or two, let's say.
Right.
Because every year is so precious when you're a young person. And so what would it look like to pair the money with the actual mentorship knowledge piece? And could that make the money stretch a lot further? And that's the idea. So you take this $10,000 and suddenly we can invest $1,000 in 10 different kids, pay for ACT tutoring, pay for them to actually take the ACT. I mean, that's a huge one right there just alone. But we're also using the money for things like we have one student that's going to be studying abroad in Spain this summer.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
Congratulations.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And like that's a life-changing experience for someone who is interested in practicing medicine and wants to lean into her bilingual skills and capabilities and understand her heritage even,
yeah,
right? And so there's those experiences and stories are investments for a lifetime of someone, right? Who then can get other money from other sources, right? Like that's the idea.
Absolutely.
So how do we stretch it? And how do we lean into what assets already exist in rural America, which are people who really care about their homes and want to invest in its future?
Yeah. You know, and it's funny you say that. And I don't know if I told you this. I actually have a son, my youngest son, who's a sophomore at Fayetteville High School. He's actually over in Spain studying right now. He's there for a year.
Awesome.
In what's called the Rotary Youth Exchange. And I've really, now, he was mature to begin with. Otherwise, we wouldn't have let him go out of the country. But I mean, what this dude has experienced in the time that he's been there, and he's there for almost a year. I mean, it's the amount of maturity that I've seen in him is incredible.
That's amazing.
And there's something to be said for kind of pulling someone, especially someone at a young age, out of their existing environment and putting them into a whole new environment that, you know, either your body is going to wake up quickly and discover, oh my gosh, I got to get my act together. I have to carry myself a certain way. I have to learn how to communicate more effectively. There's so many aspects that play into that. And I think young people nowadays aren't always fully equipped.
Right.
Just to handle the daily grind of life, right? And, mm-hmm. and it's one of the challenges that we, you know, that's why Jonathan Haidt wrote The Anxious Generation. And I mean, so much Jonathan of that is coming to pass now because of, for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, programs like what you're doing kind of step in at certain junctures in young people's lives where they need someone to come up alongside of them,
right,
to put their arm around them metaphorically and help them through a certain phase of life so that they can mature and ultimately be the fully functioning adults that we hope every young person becomes.
Right. Absolutely. We're another adult in these students' lives.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not a parent who also has, for a lot of these students, their first generation low income, right? One or the other or both. And so they'll have a parent who maybe doesn't understand what the student's going through or what the student's goals are and how they hope to achieve them.
Yeah.
So having another adult can be, you know, a learning experience in how to engage with adults, right? I mean, having a mentorship relationship, that's a skill set that will serve you for a lifetime, knowing how to have a mentor. But then also having a mentor who can say, great job.
Yeah.
I mean,
just as simple as that.
Literally. Yeah. I mean, that's one thing I found. My first inaugural cohort, right, for Compass, my mentee was Carla Lopez. And I want to shout her out because she's amazing. She's a freshman at the U of A studying on a full ride. She's pre-law, and that's what she wanted to do when we met. You know, she's interested in history, interested in the law. But I remember, you know, the first 6 months of our relationship, it's learning, like we're catching up to speed. You know, I'm learning about her, understanding what's going on. By like her whole senior year, practically, it was just, you're doing a great job. Just keep going.
Yeah.
You're doing a great job. Just keep going. Like every time, like, hey, no one else might be telling you this. And I assume she had other people encouraging her, including teachers and staff.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, that's what I found it ended up being. And because she just is doing a great job.
Right.
Yeah. And that matters a lot.
And we take words like that for granted sometimes because we just, especially if you grow up in an environment or in a family where you are positively affirmed, you just assume, oh, everybody is affirmed like this. And that couldn't be further from the truth. It could not be. Because then you hear all these stories from people who are like, no one ever told me I was doing a good job, ever.
Yeah.
And so it's like, wow, okay. And that's why I think the positive affirmations and the positive reinforcement that you have provided through this program, that in and of itself is huge.
Right.
For the audience that are listening, I would love for you maybe to kind of just explain the whole Compass Scholar model for the listeners. How does it work? Like if you were to just walk us through just a quick cliff note version
I'll
of
do
how
a quick,
it works.
I'll do my best to be quick here. I know I can talk.
It's fine. No, this is a great conversation, man. This is, I think there's somebody's going to hear this, and whether it's a parent of a child that's trying to figure themselves out, or it could be a young person in high school, or it could be somebody that's in college that needs some further inspiration and wants to support what you're doing. Somebody's going to hear this and act upon it.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. So the idea is we recruit students in their sophomore year.
Okay.
And so in that fall semester, we put out an application early on. We reach that marketing looks like social media and then the teachers and identifying students.
Yep.
So it's this, get people to apply.
Yeah.
And then, so we review their application. It's a pretty simple application process, right? And then we have an interview. And the interview is really important because it shows how the students engage with their like classmates. So these are group-based interviews, activity-based interviews. And then from there, we select students. And this is based on leadership potential, academic merit, need, and then like teacher recommendation, which kind of ties up all of those things, right?
You also mentioned a heart for community service too.
Yes, service. Okay. Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Service is important. Yeah. It is. Those are the four pillars. Thank you. Yeah. And so we pick students based on those criteria. And then in that spring semester, it's all about building community.
Yeah.
That's it. They get to meet their mentor. We talk about getting organized. We introduce them to the ideas of like, there are these big standardized tests that are going to affect your life, you know, depending on what you want to do. And so it's really about what is this thing? Like get used, you know, this is a new part of your life. Then in that fall semester, we're more focused on personal development, right? So who are you? How do you see yourself in the world? What are you interested in doing, right? They're starting to deepen, students are starting to deepen how they're thinking about themselves. And we're also thinking about their capstone experience, which is going to be the summer following their junior year.
Sure.
So if you think that this is who you are, how could you explore that?
Yeah.
Right. And that's like the student going to Spain. One of my mentees is going to be working as a camp counselor. We've had students start like future healthcare professionals chapter for their school, right? Like it's a capstone experience that encourages the student to push themselves and explore if that's something that they're actually interested in or not, right? And so then the spring semester is really focused on gearing up for that capstone, but also learning how to write personal narratives. So now we've thought about who we are, how can we put it on paper for an applicant review committee?
Sure.
And then also we have like college panels and career panels to further deepen what that exploration looks like for students, right?
So you're constantly preparing them as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
The whole time. Yeah. And so then the idea is that their senior year, we're really letting them loose, right? So it's FAFSA workshops in the fall. It's a lot of application workshops. And then we'll also have like guest speakers to offer some inspiration in the middle of what can be really difficult. And then in the spring semester, we talk more about financial, personal finance, financial, like economic mobility.
Yeah.
What does it look like to make decisions, like really, really important decisions about, hey, I can go to my dream school and I can get $200,000 in debt, or I can go to this school that's great. It's maybe not my dream school, but I'm going to have $0 in debt. And how do I weigh those, right? And I think there are valid reasons to choose either option, like very valid reasons, but they come with their own consequences. And so what's a framework for thinking about decisions like that? And if you're first generation low income, typically it's just none of the above.
Right.
I think college can really just feel like, well, it's just not an option.
Yeah.
And so the overarching of the five semesters is, no, this is something like anything else in life, right? That you can prepare for. You can build the skills towards it. And at a minimum, the students will leave with a sense of how to present themselves professionally.
Sure.
And how to navigate making big life decisions.
First impressions matter.
Yes, they do.
They really do.
They matter really so do. Much.
Yeah.
So we do have professional development workshops. There's so many things layered
building
in.
Building relationships. I'm constantly having this conversation with my sons. I'm like, man, don't be transactional.
Yeah.
You know, connect with people. People will respect you if you look them in their eyes and when you talk to them. And so, and that's honestly a challenge that a lot of young people have right now, that they're not able to do that.
Right.
I can't tell you the number of young people that I talk to that won't even look me in the eye.
Right.
And I know some of it is just their struggles with this device that we carry around in our pocket, among other things. But, you know, I try to, when and where possible, share just encouraging words and remind young people that, you know, that they have an opportunity to connect with the next generation and also people that have come before them, because everybody's been there and done that.
Right.
We all have the t-shirt to show for it, especially if we've made it through the teenage years.
Yeah.
And so there's always going to be some encouraging words, something that we can share with the next generation to help them be the best version of themselves.
And what I love about that is, and I didn't mention the community service mindset that's baked in throughout the program. And the capstone is always encouraged to be more, is a community service oriented project.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be. But what we're trying to create, and we've seen it with our current, so we have one class from Farmington that's graduated now, like I mentioned, Carla.
Yeah.
And they all are excited to give back, right? They want to give back to the program. And that's the vision for Compass, is that you have chapters that can start up. Like I said, it's a pretty low cost program. And so you can kick start a chapter in your hometown, in your school district, which is what we've done in County Line, Arkansas, and we've done in Kimball, Nebraska, where Nicholas is from.
Okay.
And County Line's with one of our board members, Braden Bateman, who's from County Line himself. And that's what we find is we have a community champion who really believes in what we're doing. And then it's about kickstarting this cycle where in 10, 20, 30 years, you have hundreds of Compass alumni, right, who recognize the importance of what they were taught and how they've carried that with them, and also have that value of service to give back to their hometown and mentor the next student and to help with fundraising even for the chapter, whatever that looks like. And it's about creating a actual infrastructure for maintaining real and social capital in rural small towns where folks are coming from.
And I'm glad you mentioned about the fundraising piece, because as I listened to you, and I know you talked about this before when we spoke, you guys typically provide about $1,000 per student over five semesters, which isn't a lot of money in the grand scheme of things.
Right.
And you've kind of alluded to some of the things that that covers. I'm curious to know, how do you get those that are participating on your end of it, whether they are mentors or other people in the program, to show them that the value of time is really, the value is really the time that you're able to invest in the program.
Yeah.
The money is important too, but it's the time that people need, right? Because I could give any kid, any random kid, $1,000, you know, whatever they do with it. I mean, I don't know.
Right.
Right. It just depends. but when you actually take time out of your schedule to spend with a young person and kind of, you know, put your arm around them, or just kind of walk them through the process of adulting and figuring life out and overcoming obstacles and, you know, picking themselves up when they fail at something and dusting themselves off to keep moving forward. You know, that requires time.
A lot of time.
Money will not solve that problem.
Right.
You know, and I'm just curious to know, how do you articulate that part of the vision?
Yes. I think a huge part of it is asking for help. Yeah. I did it recently. I put a call out for mentors, and it was our first time ever doing like an open call for mentors.
Yep.
And I was really blown away by who showed up. I mean, we had more mentors than we needed. Like, it was amazing. You know, people really, and from one social media post, right? And I've suddenly got high school classmates I haven't seen in years who are showing up because they want to give back and they believe in the mission. They believe what they're hearing and they recognize the importance of it. And so for me, the time piece is so critical. You're absolutely right. But it gives back, I think, is the other thing I would say. Is like, it's one of those things that, you know, if you have the time for it, you will learn and grow significantly from your time as a mentor and mentoring a young person who's navigating what is a volatile world, right? And is navigating new things, like you bring up the phone and like, how do you have a relationship with that? Like, you know, does that come up in your conversations? Or I think that I also would just say that it's something that is just, it gives more than you give back, right? And it's worth every penny. And it's also one of the, as a young person, whenever you don't have a lot of disposable income, it's one of the best ways to be able to give back to your hometown that you care about.
Sure.
I mean, I know what that's like, right? Being abroad in Oxford and feeling like I have a strong sense of connection home. I want to be giving back. How do I? It's like, I could do that. I did do Compass from Oxford during my last year.
Yeah.
Right? So it's something that also, like, let's say you're from Pocahontas, Arkansas, you can start a chapter in Pocahontas. You know, you can do that and not be there all of the time too, you know?
Right.
So anyway, I think that's my reflection there.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned Pocahontas. With regard to the rural question, how do you define rural for Compass scholars? And the reason why I ask you that is because some people would think of Farmington as not being rural per se.
Right.
Right. But some of these other places you mentioned, yeah, I could see that.
Right.
And I'm just curious, as like this area continues to grow, are there still places within Northwest Arkansas, within the confines of Northwest Arkansas, that would qualify as rural versus like, say, somebody in Fayetteville?
Yeah. I think Farmington, if it wasn't my hometown, I don't think it would be the first place to establish a Compass chapter.
And it's no problem with Farmington.
Of course not. So. But it's not, it's like I mentioned it, like the first question, it's more of a suburban town at this point, but it has its rural flavor and heritage, right? But it's not the same. And it's also well-resourced compared to a lot of these rural districts that's the problem we're really trying to address, right?
Yeah.
And so when I think of rural, I'm thinking of a 1A, a 2A school, right? I mean, I'm thinking of St. Paul. Right. I'm thinking of a County Line. Pocahontas is a little bit bigger. It's a little on the bigger end, but that is also a rural district.
And Alpena, Mount Magazine, some places like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mountainburg. Right. But even Gravett, you know, Decatur, if we're thinking Northwest Arkansas, right?
Yep.
And so when I think about what's our role in Northwest Arkansas specifically, I see it as connectivity, right, to the region, because you have these small towns that are quickly becoming where I think families sort of move out to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's about investing in people that are already there.
Yeah.
Right. And then connecting them to the Northwest Arkansas region and the economic opportunities there. Right. Because what you have, I don't want to generalize, but you could see how people are moving in droves to Northwest Arkansas. What's the number you would know better?
40
than
a day.
40 a day.
Yeah.
And so you have 40 people a day moving in. Well, they're going to be moving to Farmington or Prairie Grove or Lincoln.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm just thinking west because that's my neck of the woods. But, you know, like they're going to be moving out those places. Well, there have been people there for so long that are not well connected to the corporate job opportunities.
Right.
Even feel like the University of Arkansas is a far cry from them.
Yeah.
And so that's an important investment for overall connectivity of the region in connecting, like I said, like you've got young professionals that are in Northwest Arkansas that are mentoring students in Farmington or in Lincoln or in St. Paul. Right. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, certainly you have your work cut out for you because there's a lot of opportunity, especially here in Arkansas, a state of 3.1 million people. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity. There's a lot of rural regions of Arkansas. So, I mean, you certainly have a lot of opportunity to really grow this model and experience some success. Speaking of success, what would success look like 10 to 20 years from now? You mentioned alumni sustaining the program.
Right.
What does success look like for you with this program?
Yeah, I think in 10 to 20 years, it's hard to imagine like exactly where it'll go because I want it to be community led. I really don't want it to be like, I want to be out of the way of these communities unlocking what's already existing within them. And so, but I would hope that it looks like 50 to 100 chapters across the state,
mm-hmm.
right? I hope it looks like a convention over the summer, right, that takes place over a week or two, that's an immersive experience for students to be able to come together and really, really steep themselves in the learning around leadership, around community service and what that looks like, and around their own personal development and growth, right? And then I also see it spanning between Nebraska and Arkansas. I see it as a heartland model, and that's the original reason that Nicholas and I really linked on it is because this is an underserved part of the country.
Yeah.
This whole middle America. And so I hope that it stretches throughout that region. That's like a 20-year project, right? But that we have Missouri and Kansas and Nebraska, and they're covered, right? And we're fitting that region of the country. Anyway, and then as far as like how the students have been impacted, I mean, in 10 to 20 years, I hope we've got lawyers and doctors and engineers and nurses and teachers and nonprofit workers and you know, politicians even, you know, I hope that we are seeing like leaders of our state emerging and popping up. And it just so happens, oh, they're a Compass Scholar, right? And this is a program that shaped their attitudes and their behaviors and how they decided to carry out their life because they see the value of giving. And you're always, it's never transactional, right? It's always you give and you give and you give and you'll always receive more than you could have ever given. And that kind of attitude, that is something that is, it's intangible, but could really transform our state in the long run.
Oh, 100%. And I mean, yeah, you said it perfectly. And I think it's, when you think of it, it's in the same way that we would look at the Rhodes Scholar Program, right? It's like so many people that become Rhodes Scholars go on to do amazing things.
Right.
Just like the young people that are becoming Compass Scholars, they're going to go on to do amazing things and then figure out a way to pay it forward.
Right.
And that will kind of create that momentum.
Right.
You know, that inertia that we need to continue to move this idea forward.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I fail to mention, and this happens because I have this bias, and I want to acknowledge it on like here, because I have this bias because I have like my master's degree, like I'm a well-educated person. But we also, one of our Compass Scholars from the Arkansas cohort is apprenticing as a plumber. And I see plumbers, I see tradesmen, I see Tanner Greens, I see, you know, entrepreneurs also emerging from this program, right? And I know that can throw off like exactly how we, you know, what the service delivery looks like, but the intangible skills and attitudes are there always, right? And so you see like those kinds of jobs being, yeah, critically important. And I think I fail to mention, it shows my bias, and it's why I've got a great team that always reminds me.
Well, and I'm glad you kind of mentioned that, because like everybody's not cut out for school.
Yeah.
But everybody is cut out to go do something great in the world.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't, you know, 4 years of college is not in the cards for everyone.
Yes.
And I think the challenge that we have is that we don't continue to teach after high school critical thinking.
Right.
And certain skills that young people need to continue to evolve as adults.
Right.
And to be fully functioning members of society.
Yeah, right.
I think it's important. And so I'm glad you brought that up, because I think the trades are just as important. And honestly, they're going to become even more important in the years to come.
Absolutely.
We don't have enough plumbers. We don't have enough electricians. We don't have enough fill in the blank.
Yeah, masons.
Workers, masons, yeah. You name it. And so there's a real value there. And those individuals can learn these skills as well and apply it in their everyday life. And applied in the work that they do, as well as in the with the people that they interact with.
Yes, absolutely. I think I just want to shout him out, Brandon Clark. He's that graduate, and Brandon is a leader.
Yeah.
He is a leader, and he will have a transformative impact wherever he goes.
Sure.
And so he's a perfect example of those values embodied, but not in the college setting, not in this like formal academic setting. And I also see when we're thinking about reimagining what rural looks like in the 21st century, because we're in the middle of that. The rural economy with globalization, not to get too academic here,
yeah.
But with globalization and consolidation of agriculture, right? Like the rural economy looks really different.
Totally.
And it doesn't need to be all negative, even though it has had some negative consequences on what it has looked like.
Right.
But I think it can be really positive, and that is investing in more than just college opportunities. It's also like you look at like a Manila and training up students and connecting them to opportunities to work at the steel mill,
yeah.
Right? Great jobs that lead to homeownership really quickly and building generational wealth. You know, we have to be rooted in local context and serving that local community and creating the kind of leaders that are going to champion in that community for years and years to come.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, man, we don't have a lot of time left, but I do want to talk about perpetuation and how you continue this process. So who are your partners in this work right now, currently, and how are you funded?
Right.
And how can people help you if they want to after listening to this?
Yes. Yeah. So partners are our staff, who is largely volunteer at this point. So you've got like your Braden Bateman in County Line, your Nicholas, your Tanner Green, your Emily Snell. I got to shout out everyone, right? Bailey King, Tyler Pugh. And then we have our like cohort leads, you know, Doug Pham, Claire O'Neill. And they're like the ones that are really, you know, Caleb Williams. Oh my gosh, Caleb's been unbelievable on the IT side. And we just got a new hire there as well. And those are the partnerships. These are people that are just giving lots and lots of time to build infrastructure and
sure.
Make us punch way above our weight for the fact that like we're not just like flush with cash, but
yeah.
We do have money. And we raised $15,000 this past December in like an end of year giving campaign. We have our original $10,000. And actually the Rhodes Trust invested a service year for me to like spend a year doing some sort of active service. That money was supposed to go to me. I really just put it into the business, you know? And so we have money, but as far as perpetuation goes, we need more people.
Yeah.
Honestly, we need more volunteers. We need people that say, hey, I know how to run a program, or I know how to teach, like, and I would love to help out. We also need folks that are willing to host events,
yeah.
Fundraising events. I'm so new to this world of asking people for money, to be honest with you. It's like really a bizarre one for me, but we need it and we need to do it. And that's my job. And so, you know, if you can give, it's at compassfound.org. If you are looking to give in more than, if you're looking to expand your donation to more, please hit us on the contact information and we will reach out to you about facilitating something. If you want to start a chapter, let us know. And yeah, we got to keep this thing moving. And fortunately, we have a great staff, but we've got to build something that can persist beyond our youth and excitement.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I don't know how you're doing. I mean, you've got so much on your plate, and even I think you may be running for city council.
That's right.
In
Ward 1.
To add one more thing to what you're doing, how does that kind of fit into your broader vision for the community?
Yeah. I think that I just believe so much in our ability to work together. And I think in a time of division like we have right now, we have a lot of energy that is just being poured into cracks between us. You know what I mean? Yeah. And we need to work together. And so my running for city council is focus on the local. We've got to focus on the local, you know, and we can't seem to wrap our heads around what the future of Fayetteville looks like.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do. I'm not acting like it's just some trivial thing that we're just dumb or like, no, it's really difficult, but we need to learn how to do that and practice that muscle. And for me, that's the vision for my career too, is bringing people together and trying to solve what seem to be impossibly difficult problems. Well, we can find solutions. The most important thing is that we learn how to work together and communicate and disagree with one another and find compromise.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so well put. And, you know, I mean, we're all political animals, right?
Right.
You know, we have to learn how to play our part in that process. And I think a lot of people currently in our current state of affairs are waking up to the fact that, man, actually, I do have a voice.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure that it's heard.
So much.
Yeah.
And that can be through mentoring a young person.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, right.
Right. And that can be through canvassing doors, you know, door knocking and talking to folks and trying to get them to vote for your candidate of choice. There are so many ways, but that service is so important. But it's service that's open-handed and it's inviting people to join you,
right?
Right. So that we can all build something, because one person, you know, or one team can't do it. And it's something that I'm still learning. In college, it was easy because you have a ton of people that have lots of free time.
Yeah.
In the real world, we've all got to be making an income. And so you've got to figure out who is excited.
It's a whole different
ball game. Yes, it is.
It's a whole different ball game. Once again, I want you to reiterate how people can support the work you're doing with Compass.
Yeah. Well, I think the biggest thing is donations would make a huge difference. We now have mentors for every single student for the next year.
Yep.
And so the most important thing would be a donation or hosting an event. If that even would just be like a house party, or if it's you have something that we could come table at, opportunities for us to build awareness.
Okay.
So let me make that clear. A donation on our website. It's always available for a donation.
Give the address
compassfound.org.
Okay. We'll put everything that has been mentioned today, we'll put in the show notes.
Thanks.
But yeah, I certainly want to just make sure you mention this again for people that are listening.
Absolutely. And it gives us, the most important thing with a donation like this, we're about to go through Northwest Arkansas Gives, is it also is a sign that this is something that you believe in. This is something that you think is important for our community, you think is important for the state. And so every donation, even if it's just a dollar, makes a massive difference for showing that we have public support for this. And so that would be the number one thing. And I think I'll just leave it simply there.
That's perfect. Yeah. And we'll make sure we put a link on that. And we will, whatever you guys share out during NWA giving time, we'll make sure that we reshare that so that people know, because we always like to highlight the organizations that we really believe in here at I Am Northwest Arkansas. So we'll be sure to share with our audience and, you know, just kind of reaffirm. So please tag us
in
anything that you put out, and we'll be happy to reshare, like and reshare it for sure.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
it means a lot. I mean, the platform to share what we're doing is important. And yeah, we're just trying to help students find their direction after high school, you know.
So, yeah. Well, man, I'm so excited that you and Nicholas stepped out in faith and did this, and that Tanner is helping you with it. And really for everybody that has, you know, that is in your orbit trying to make this thing come to pass. You know, I always say, and I joke about this, but I'm not joking. It does take a village, right?
It does.
To make things happen. And so none of us can do it on our own. And as I tell my sons all the time, no man or woman is an island unto themselves, right? We can only grow with others. So, I mean, it's been an honor to sit down with you. I knew this was going to be a special conversation, and we're over an hour now. So I'm in Joe Rogan territory with this podcast episode. But honestly, it's been so good. I couldn't press stop. And I really, you know, you have a message and a story that people need to hear. So I want to thank you for taking the time to do what you're doing, for representing Arkansas so amazingly at Oxford, for representing the University of Arkansas, even with its challenges that it's currently having right now. And that's an understatement, but that's a topic for another day.
That's right.
But man, I really appreciate the work that you're doing. And, you know, any way that we can help, please let us know. And hopefully that this podcast episode will go near and far and serve as a beacon for the brand that is the Compass Foundation as you continue to grow it and as you continue to impact one young life at a time. So, man, just keep doing the work that you're doing, Coleman, and we really appreciate having you on this episode.
I appreciate you, Randy. Thank you so much for the time.
Absolutely. Well, folks, there you have it. Another episode of the I Am Northwest Arkansas podcast. I hope you enjoyed that. It's just some really, really great information. And, you know, I just think you know, what Coleman is building with Compass Scholars is exactly what we mean when we talk about the future being local, seeing a need, rolling up your sleeves, and creating something that makes a real difference. For those listening who want to learn more about Compass Scholars, support the work, or get involved as a mentor, we'll have all the links in the show notes. And remember, this episode is part of our series with the Walton Family Foundation, exploring the people and ideas shaping Northwest Arkansas. If you enjoyed this conversation, make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss the rest of this series. Thanks for tuning in to I Am Northwest Arkansas. We'll see you next week with another new episode of the podcast. Peace.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of I Am Northwest Arkansas. Check us out each and every week, available anywhere that great podcasts can be found. For show notes or more information on becoming a guest, visit iamnorthwestarkansas.com. We'll see you next week on I Am Northwest Arkansas.